My grandfather had a story about a teenager in the neighborhood in Dorchester who had banged on his car with a pipe and had vandalized his car. And I think the police caught him and took him to the station house, and my grandfather was there. They were asking him questions, and he said, "I don't know what you're talking about. I've never seen your car in my life. Don't know who you are." And so they didn't have anything on the kid, and my grandfather said to him, "Okay, you win, but let me ask you this. What did I ever do to you to make you want to smash up my brand new Buick?" And the kid said, "It was not brand new, it was a 49.
In the very beginning of our interview, you mentioned a lot of friends you had.
Oh, yeah.
Could you tell me some stories about those friends?
Yeah. Well, geez, one of my oldest friends, his name is Scott McLeod. We used to sit around and draw together and make comics, and he was really kind of obsessed with comics as a young teenager, and I can remember him... at some point was really interested in superhero comics. I couldn't understand superhero comics. I thought they were boring and that they were hard to look at and you had to know all this stuff like baseball stats, and I could see that people were really into it, but I just felt like I lacked whatever it took to appreciate this form that to me was this incomprehensible thing. Well, later Scott ended up making comic books, then publishing a book about comics that became a big deal. So he it's something he thought a lot about, and so we used to sit around and draw. I can remember him showing me how to draw 3D pictures. You draw two pictures and shift some of the objects around and cross your eyes and you look at them and see the depth, and it was a fun thing to do, or just making drawings in chalk on his concrete driveway that went kind of downhill into a garage. And there was another guy across the street. His name was Chris Bing. He ended up being a illustrator of children's books and writer of children's books. There was, a lot of people in the neighborhood. Crispin Wood, he also draws. He's a musician, was in various Boston rock bands, and old friend of mine, John Hardy, who lives in Gloucester, runs a bakery now with his wife. Guy David Shure, who I haven't seen in many years, who's a comp lit professor now. I could just go on and on, just naming people. Chris Blue, who lives in Arlington now, musician. Strange thinker. And a lot of these friends, when we were teenagers, we would make tapes. We would get together often in my basement or other people's basements with a two-track cassette recorder and a couple of microphones and just make up crazy music, make weird rock music, take turns singing them or making up the words, playing instruments. So that was a thing that we had a lot of fun doing as teenagers, and still have scads of these tapes. Haven't heard them in yet many years. Hope they're not all flaked away. So many of them, you'd always hear somebody saying, "Oh, we'll erase that," because we were often mad at each other when we made them and thought we would erase them, but then when we heard them later, they didn't seem so bad. Remember one year when there was a gypsy moth infestation and they were just everywhere, and at night you'd hear this white noise of the chewing sound everywhere, and everything was kind of defoliated. And I remember a friend of mine having an allergic reaction to them, if they touch your skin or your face, and I can remember her face being very swollen and discolored because of the gypsy moths, and she had to stay out of school for a day because of the ravaging that they had done. I remember it was such a big deal just to go from a car to your front door, because you'd have to walk through this flurry of moths and they'd just be bashing into you as you're trying to get the key in the lock and open the door as quickly as you can, get in the house and try not to let the moths in. But luckily, you know, that only lasted a season. Yeah, it really is good when you appreciate being exempt from bugs. You know, living in Catskill, you know, you have some bugs, but it's not an infestation or anything. And of course, now we've got the, you know, the cicadas coming and all that, but I don't know that they'll, it's not like they're going to take over the place or anything like that. I remember once visiting somebody in New Hampshire, and it was so thick with mosquitoes. It must have been a super mosquito season, because it was, again, a big deal just to walk a short distance to get from a car to a door without being devoured. I was glad that I didn't live there.
So, one of the things you mentioned a lot was music. Could you tell me how you got into music?
Yeah, well, just from, you know, hearing my father play, listening to records. You know, we had Beatle records. They were varied records. I can remember the Edgar Varèse record, which had this piece, Poem Electronique, from the mid-50s on it, which was a big influence, this wonderful, crazy thing. So there was music in the house, and learning about organ music just through my father's interest in it, and getting drawn into that. And then later, you know, making music with friends and making recordings and improvising and, you know, doing less disciplined things. Well, there was a discipline to it too, but we got to, you know, in those kinds of things, you know, not trying to make a compose a proper piece of music, but it was sort of more of a, almost a theatrical thing, doing different voices or just trying to cook up something weird. Or, you know, act first, ask questions later kinds of activities. So, yeah, definitely a big part of growing up. It's so funny to think of, you know, how central records were and cassettes being the thing that you could actually record onto, and now, you know, how long ago that seems. Or, you know, I can remember how sudden it was, the switch from LPs being the main medium to CDs becoming the main medium instead of a special, more expensive hi-fi thing. And now what's funny is people will declare, oh, CDs are dead, and even though they're not dead, they're just in decline, or it's not the only game in town. But it's still a way to load up stuff that you can put into a computer. So it's not like you just have them to play on players. But yeah, that was the only way to get something down. Well, maybe you've seen, there were these like before tape recorders were really sold as a domestic thing that you can buy, there were little record cutting lathes that cut a 78. You know, like on a lacquer or something. I can remember reading in a book by this Russian author, he describes his growing up in the 50s and, you know, people coveting to have all the American stuff, the blue jeans, the jazz records, the rock and roll, and him talking about these bones records, they called them, because they were made from X-ray films that were discarded, and they'd use that as a record lacquer and cut a bootleg jazz record on that. And then you'd have this blank thing that was, you know, an X-ray of somebody's femur or their rib cage or something, and that was your jazz record. I thought, that is such a cool thing. So when I went to college, I got to study organ, but also composition and electronic music. So it was great to be able to work with these wonderful synthesizers that were like right at the tail end of the analog era, and the digital stuff was new, and they got a, you know, one of the early digital synthesizers, the DX7, and people were going ape over it, but these other things were still in place, and those were just such wonderful instruments. Of course, now they're valuable antiques, but at that time they were beginning to be seen as the obsolete, outmoded thing that was old-fashioned. So, you know, that's always an ongoing thing. I've got so many wonderful instruments for free because somebody needed to get rid of or unload something that was considered an albatross or an embarrassment or yesterday's news. And then time goes on, and then they become venerated as antiques. But they have to go through that period first of being a reviled embarrassment that is not modern. God forbid. So... yeah, I went to Oberlin College, which also has there's a conservatory and there's a liberal arts college. I was a college student but got to enroll in the conservatory, and I had friends who were in the conservatory who were enrolled in the college. And I had a wonderful teacher named Joe Wood, very unappreciated. He was just about to retire. Very funny and cantankerous person. I think he was an excellent teacher, but he was hated by students, I think just because they thought of him as the old fogey or something. I thought he was great, and he was a really salty guy. I can remember we went to see, and this was in 1984, John Cage came to Oberlin to do a concert, and it was a retrospective of his work from the 30s up until his brand new 1984 piece. So we heard the concert, and there was a reception afterwards, and you know, there were a lot of people who wanted to talk to Cage, so we were just hanging back because we didn't have anything that he needed to hear to say. And I can remember Joe Wood saying to me, "The man is a tremendous talent. But really, there was no excuse for that last piece." And I liked how he was so unequivocal in his admiration of him, but wasn't into the later stuff. And it was interesting to hear the development from the early stuff, which to me, in some ways, was the most exciting to listen to in the concert hall. I liked the later thing, too, but it was much, you know, more of a kind of purely theoretical thing. But I can remember the first score I ever showed to Joe Wood. It had a part for an electric guitar in it, and he just threw it down on the desk and said, "Guitar! Twang, twang!" So, I remember after college getting a job at a software company in Cambridge, Mass, for a while as an illustrator for some sort of educational software. And it was a small company that was just starting out and had made a lot of money with something that they had put out, and they had bought what were then a kind of novelty thing, the kneeling computer chair that you you know, sort of slanted and your weight rests sort of on your knees and you sit in this kind of in-between position. And they had bought a lot of these things, and then they were done with them, so they all had now like regular office chairs and pivoting chairs on casters, and they piled all these new utopian kneeling chairs in a closet from floor to ceiling. So I needed something to sit on when I got there to work, and so I pulled one of these off the stack, and then to my surprise it was really comfortable. I thought, hey, this is good. All those things they said are true about it's taking the load off your back. And so I remember thinking it was funny to have so much enjoyment of the now newly discarded utopian chair. So that job didn't last too long, and then I ended up moving to New York in 87 and had a friend, Matt Verdery, who said, you know, hey, you should move to New York and we'll start a band and we'll share an apartment. I said, okay. And so I came to New York, and the apartment plans bottomed out, but I crashed on the floor of some people we knew for a couple of weeks and started in Brooklyn, lived briefly in the East Village, and then ended up in Williamsburg from 87 until 2006. Then I moved to Catskill, and I've been here since then. So, but I enjoyed all the years that I lived in New York. all the places that I used to play are gone now and were gone before I moved away. But I really had fun the whole time I was there and, you know, got my start there and got some things going. I was afraid when I moved away from New York I wouldn't be able to make a living anymore because I wasn't knocking around in New York picking up work. But I had knocked around long enough that I was able to keep it going and still show at a gallery, a pierogi gallery in Brooklyn, sometimes have some shows there, some drawings or film strips. Sometimes I'll do some live things in there. So it worked out well. I came up to Catskill just looking for a way to have my own place, you know, be an owner, have more workspace, lower my overhead. And I could always go to New York if I needed to go to New York, but I didn't really need to be there all the time anymore. And that worked out well for me. I love being in the Hudson Valley. I just came up because it was cheap, and then it ended up being so beautiful. And I had a solitary life for a long time, but then I got to know some more people. Some more people I knew ended up around here, and so now I have to watch out not to goof off too much of the time.
So, when you say goofing off,
well, I mean, like, hanging out with people, hang out with friends, standing around talking when you need to get somewhere, or get a bunch of work done by a deadline. So, when I first came to Catskill, I was kind of braced for the isolation and was surprised at how much I enjoyed it. And I got a lot of stuff done because you don't get caught up in all sorts of stuff when you're in a more of a social world and you're always running into people and getting caught up in things. So that was actually pretty cool. Now it's very sociable and fun, and I like that. So also, I never felt like I had to be in the city, like I'm having withdrawal symptoms for the city or something like that. I didn't grow up in a city either. So sometimes people would say, well, wasn't that a big shock, you know, to live in such a different place? So it was very different, but it wasn't a shock to the system or, you know, I wasn't ordering food from any kind of restaurant at any hour of the day or things that people imagine that you can get in New York, which isn't even really true. It's amazing how much the city that never sleeps goes to sleep. And you can't find some place that's open. Well, I used to live two blocks from Kellogg's Diner in Brooklyn, which had been there forever and was a 24-hour place. It was much reviled for being this D-Class A place, but I always liked it, and they certainly were fine with the burgers and fries. And it was always open, so it was very dependable, and it was cheap. Well, the last time I tried to go there, it was 4 o'clock in the morning, and there was a line out the door. But I guess there were just so many people around, and that's the only place that's open to get food after midnight or something. And I thought, gee, in Catskill, I can go to the Price Chopper 24 hours. Couldn't do that in Williamsburg. Interesting, too, to meet people who, you know, lived in the Bronx or lived in New York and then retired and came, you know, to a place like Catskill. Or some of my neighbors, you know, that was their story. There was a guy who worked for the post office for years who was full of these hilarious stories. You know, he was a Korean War veteran, and he would tell stories of how he kind of went on some sort of bender and shot up all of this stuff with a machine gun and maybe got some sort of mild reprimand for it, but it was, you know, he had all these stories of that kind of, you know, either military mayhem or post office mayhem, and people reading the racehorse sheets on the toilet and people spying on them through the transom and all kinds of things like that. So it was interesting to come up here and then meet, you know, old-timer New Yorkers who came upstate to live cheap.
Before you mentioned isolation, how do you think that how do you think that changed you?
Well, I mean, I was used to a very social life in New York, but, you know, things had changed there, and maybe I was also just more isolated anyway while I was still in New York. So when I moved, it was a good time to move because it was already a kind of a transitional time instead of feeling like I was being uprooted or something like that. But I was prepared mentally for it and kind of expected it would be tougher than it really was or turned out to be. But I think that was also that I was ripe for it. So it wasn't like it was something I was just stuck with. So I'm glad that instead of it being a lot of wear and tear on me, it was actually a kind of a relief in a way while it lasted. And well, I didn't know anybody up here when I came here. I knew some people. I have a friend who lives in New York but has a place in Germantown, which, you know, I didn't really know anything about this area until 2002. I think that was the year when I came up to show a film strip at Time and Space Limited in Hudson. So that was my introduction to Hudson and even really this area. No, some people I know had rented some house in Germantown before that, so I'd been up here, but I just didn't know much about it. I didn't know anything really about the Hudson River School of Painters and the whole history of this area. I had never even read Rip Van Winkle. I mean, it's such a universal story, but, you know, I didn't even know what it was. I just thought it was a folk tale. So a few years ago, I actually read it for the first time, and it was really amazing to read it. And I hadn't actually read Washington Irving, and he's so interesting. You know, I met some people up here, but I didn't really know anybody up here. But, you know, that changes when you stick around somewhere long enough. I was also amazed that you could, you know, get a house for under $100,000, you know, and not be in a more remote place that really is remote, because it's not remote. But that's just the way it goes. Even when I first moved to Williamsburg, I was amazed that it was as much of a bargain as it was, because I would think, well, it's the first stop in Brooklyn, just the proximity to Manhattan. You'd think it would be more expensive, but it wasn't, and it was this frumpy place in people's eyes and desolate because it was this mixed industrial residential area. So I think people were kind of scared of it, even though it was more peaceful than nicer neighborhoods, because there wasn't anybody around to hassle. So people want to hassle people or go where the people are. So, well, the South Side was dangerous then. The North Side wasn't. And you just, you know, were just sensible in those days. And then, of course, over time it became the glamour spot. But I enjoyed living there the whole time I did. I remember the first apartment I had there, I split it with a roommate. The rent was $425 a month. And I thought, you know, an apartment like this really ought to be $375 a month, not $425 a month.
How did you know you were ready to go to the Hudson?
Well, I remember in order to get a decent paying gig, I had to get out of town. And so I was beginning to think, well, what am I doing here where it just gets more expensive as time goes by, and I'm trying to do woodworking, and that means having enough room to make a mess. And I lived in a wonderful place, the same place, for 18 years. So it was great being there, but there was less reason for me to stay because, all the better gigs, at least as far as performing goes, you had to get out of New York. And so I just thought, well, I guess I really may as well live somewhere where it's cheap, and then just go to New York when I need to go to New York. My favorite place to play was Tonic. That was a really wonderful place on Norfolk Street. I can remember it was a big deal when it opened, and that was always a really hospitable place to go hear something as well as to perform. I kind of got my start at a small club in Williamsburg in the late 80s called The Bog. And that was a great place. That was a fun place. You'll do-it-yourself kind of place. And then there was a little place called Quiet Life that I was mixed up in that only lasted about 6 months. There was a fire. When was that? Was that in 1990? The Happy Land fire. There was a club called Happy Land in the Bronx, and there was some horrible thing where somebody, you know, went to a gas station and filled a gas can and torched a place that all these people were in. It was an illegal social club, and many people died in this fire, and the city cracked down on illegal social clubs as a consequence. And so then eventually that place had to close down. All the little homemade places in Williamsburg had to close down in 1990, and then there weren't any clubs for years after that. A friend of mine went to Kellogg's Diner. He saw these two guys with windbreakers on that said Mayor's Commission on Illegal Social Clubs stitched into the back of the windbreakers, and he overheard their conversation, and one guy says to the other, "So how many did you close down today?" The other guy says, "Oh, a couple. One of them, nice place."
How did you get involved in that social club?
Some friends of mine were running it. And I rented an apartment in the same building. And played there sometimes. It was a lot of fun. But yeah, it was very, very low-key, homegrown thing. The old Knitting Factory on Houston Street, that was a place where I played a lot in the late 80s, early 90s. And that was lots of fun. That was a totally fun place. Later they moved to this kind of three-story space in Manhattan, and that was okay at first, but after a while I didn't enjoy playing at the Knitting Factory anymore or seeing shows there, because it was this kind of rock show factory, kind of became more cynical in a way, and I just didn't want to go there anymore. But then they ended up having to move out of there, and they moved to Williamsburg, about four blocks from where I used to live. I did a gig there, and it was so much nicer. It was just one place, one stage, and it was like, hey, this is great. The Knitting Factory's fun again. So that was nice that things can go that way. CB's Gallery was a place I used to like to play a lot. Well, that started out as a great place to play, and over the years it kind of got worse until I decided I'm not going to play here anymore, and then it went out of business. But, it is funny how you can just... You know, how places change or don't change, you know, and enough time goes by. you see it change a lot. Yeah, it's funny to sitting here now, like think about like 19 years in New York becoming this sort of a blur to me where I have to rummage around, and since I moved here, that does make this real demarcating change in your life, changes your sense of time, kind of slows things down. So I thought it was funny when I went back to the old hardware store near where I lived, and I think the guy asked me, like, "So, you're about to move away, right?" And I said, "Oh, I moved away 5 years ago." And he said, "No!" And he couldn't believe that it had been 5 years. But time passes differently when you're in the same place. So I remember thinking that was so funny that, you know, it all just ran together for him. It was a sort of time travel-like experience with all this astronautic time slippage. Yeah, I lived at this intersection, kind of kitty corner across from Our Lady of Mount Carmel in Williamsburg. And every July there's this incredible Italian Catholic festival, the Feast of St. Paulinus. And there's this thing called the Giglio, which means lily. And this thing kind of represents the lily and this story about St. Paulinus, who goes to prison for a crime he didn't commit. And then when he returns, he's greeted on the shore by children who bring lilies. So the Giglio thing in the ceremony is this kind of a five-story structure, a tower that's carried on the shoulders of 100 or so guys, and a live brass band and a singer that are also on the platform getting carried down the street. And it's this incredible spectacle, and the streets are full of people. There's a whole carnival of rides and Ferris wheels and stuff in the street. So it is funny to feel like your house has been transported to this other place where there's all this bustling and commotion and crowds and you can't get around. And that's going on for 2 weeks. And then finally, one night, it shuts down and all the trailers leave. And suddenly it's so quiet and spacious, and you realize how quiet the neighborhood is the rest of the year. Yeah, that ceremony had been going on in that neighborhood for, you know, 100 years, and that was already several years ago. They had the 100th anniversary or whatever. There had been some sort of a cathedral or a larger church, and then when the Brooklyn Queens Expressway was built, it was right in the path of that, and it was demolished. And so this church was made to take that congregation in the 40s. And never seen pictures of the cathedral, but there's a kind of a memorial park, a little triangle that's a memorial to the church that had to make way for the BQE. One of my neighbors told me about, you know, the various rifts decades past in the neighborhood, you know, the regular Italian side and then the Sicilian side on the other side of the BQE, and how, you know, one looked askance at the other for being stuck up and the other ones looked askance at the other for being low class. And it was interesting to hear those kinds of histories from my neighbor, who then was probably about 80. There was a guy down the street named Lou who was 88 years old, and I would sit with him sometimes on his stoop. It was part of a really large apartment building, most of which was vacant and abandoned, and he lived in the one little section that was still going. And he said, you know, the landlord offered to sell me this whole place for $1. I said no. If I owned this, I wouldn't own it. It would own me. And he would say to me, you know, somebody would tell him, Lou, you ought to move to this retirement community in Florida. What do I want to go there for? This is home, here, with the garbage cans.
So, one of the things you've mentioned a lot about is moving around. Have you appreciated that? How have you appreciated moving around so much?
Well, it's funny, because I don't feel like I've moved around that much, because, you know, I have a sense of people who grew up, you know, particularly military families who moved a lot when they were a kid, or kids I knew when I was little who moved away somewhere. And except for that one blip when it was in question if we would be able to stay put, and I can remember being distraught about it, you know, never moved at all growing up. And then I lived in New York for such a long chunk of time and in the same place. I, you know, moved a bunch for the first 6 months and then sat in the same place for 18 years and accumulated a lot of stuff. I was something of a pack rat who would drag in all kinds of stuff that I found. You know, all of it cool stuff, but still like more than I could really manage. It's even still kind of true. But there was only one time I had to move all that stuff. And I did, and I had help from friends. So now I'm older and more sensible and more judicious about what I'm holding on to or not. You know, some things that seem like they might come in handy don't, and you get rid of them, and others find that special day when you need the weird piece of hardware that you trash-picked years ago. So I only really paid the consequences once of having to move the whole caboodle, like, of a one big move. But, you know, I haven't moved that much in the end. Certainly less than a lot of other people do or have. So I don't think I'll ever have to move all my LPs again. I'm not a big record collector like some people I know who have way too many records. I still haven't unpacked my whatever, 12 boxes of records. But, you know, that's not It's not enough to kill a horse.
Can you tell me a little bit more about those things you've collected?
Oh, God. I mean, a lot of them, I suppose, are just because they well, have something to it that makes you want it around. Or things. Well, also, you know, it was difficult when my father died. There were most of what he had were books. He had tons of books. He lived in a one-bedroom apartment that was overrun with books. Not very much furniture. Not very much stuff, except there were a whole lot of three-ring binders with manuscripts of papers that he wrote for physics journals. And it's all published material, but these were all written longhand. He never learned how to type, and only learned how to use a personal computer at the end of his life, when one of the commanders said, well, we have to do all the internal communications with email now. So he had to learn email, although he had never typed, wrote everything. So I had all these boxes of these manuscripts in his hand, and I just thought, like, I can't bear to get rid of this, even though, you know, there isn't anything there that it doesn't already exist as, you know, a published thing. But here it is, these manuscripts, and, you know, even his books we tried to donate to the library at the base there, but they couldn't take them. I can't remember if they were moving also. Well, his lab did ultimately move to Albuquerque, but that was after his death. Yeah, he had a horror of retirement because he loved his job. He died right before he would have had to retire. But I can remember him saying, you know, they're going to give me my 50th year pin at the base, but I hope they don't make too big a deal about it, because I don't want people to say, how old is that guy anyway? Yeah, I remember he left me a message on my answering machine. You know, one of the things he was working on at work was how a fly's eye works. And he said, I think I've gotten to the bottom of this mystery about the operation of the nipple array of the fly's eye. So I'm enjoying my mysteries. Now, the problem is, I don't know why it should be that way. But that's just God's way of pushing his thumb into my eye socket for being so dumb. But that's the way it goes. So bye for now. Yeah, my father had a stroke in 2007, which left him half paralyzed. But, you know, he worried excessively about potential dangers and things that could go wrong, but I feel like when things actually did go wrong, then he was kind of nonchalant about it, because it wasn't something that loomed large in the imagination. And you know, and even though he wasn't happy about his new condition, he said to me in the hospital after it happened, you know, everybody's number comes up eventually, I suppose, but I'm not ready to go. I'm glad I'm still alive. There's still so much more fun left to be had. And at the end of his life, he did get to go back to work, like, once or twice a week. You know, they put him in a wheelchair in a van and brought him to the base. And he was happy as a clam in mud.
That last thing, I mean, the last thing you said, your father said, there's so much fun left to be had. What type of fun do you think is left for you?
I'm lucky in that I get to have a lot of fun. A lot of the work I do is fun. The work that I do that is not fun is good, because then I, you know, get to be my own boss. So I've had very little stint in any kind of, like, salary position. The only time I did was about 7 weeks in the Blue Man Group show about 20 years ago. That was 8 shows a week, 6 days a week. And that was only supposed to last. That was supposed to be a 6 month run, but it was continuing to go over. Nobody was sure if it would last the whole 6 months. But I thought that the whole thing was like a finite 6 month thing. After 7 months, I left because I wanted to do my own stuff. And I had a zither, this electric zither, which I made in the late 80s, and used that in the show. So it was there all the time, and I couldn't go do a gig somewhere else on the one night off, Monday night. So I started making another one. But other than that, it's been all piecemeal work, freelance work, you know, either live performances or session recording stuff. Or maybe an occasional voiceover thing. Made furniture for a while. That was sort of hard because you end up not making very much money in the end, and it's still expensive for somebody to buy it. But with all this miscellaneous stuff that you can pick up, you can be your own boss and do the projects you want to do, whether they're making you money or not. Some things too, like the least likely things to ever make me any money, ended up making me money. Like I like making film strips, and I never expected to make money making film strips, but I did. I did a kind of an industrial film strip for a company called InWork. They said, can you make us a film strip about the history of graphic design before computers? So I said, sure. And I worked with them, and that was a really fun gig, and they pretty much let me do what I wanted. And that was kind of my bread and butter for a couple of years, because they kept having me come in to show it, you know, to their clients. And I'd come in there with the hand crank projector and, you know, get dressed up and do the whole show. And, you know, they were really into it. It was really funny. and it was a window into a world that I didn't know anything about. And I did a few little short film strips for the Sundance Channel, and that was a fun gig to do. I don't have copies of those, unfortunately. I never got any copies out of them, so I don't know what happened to those. So that was a gig, too. So, you know, between all these miscellaneous endeavors and handyman jobs and things, I get to be my own boss. There were times when work was dry, and I'd begin to freak out and think, well, I gotta, you know, break down and get a real job. But by then I was so ignorant about how to land a real job, even though I would have been happy to do all sorts of things, you know, that aren't fun or anything. I, you know, to hook it up, I just wasn't equipped to hook it up. Well, also, the things that people have to do, like sending billions of resumes cold, like the whole thing of cold calling people and soliciting people who don't have a need for what you do, just seems like an incredible waste of time and money. Even the whole thing that people used to do, trying to get their stuff shown in galleries, get a gallery show or be represented, they'd pound the pavement, they'd drag their slides around, you'd have to pay all this money to get all these copies of slides done. And that was just such an expensive thing, you know, that kind of put a kibosh on it for me. But the whole thing of running around and bringing your slides just seemed like this demoralizing waste of time that wasn't going to get you anywhere. So I just showed my stuff however I did. And then I got opportunities from that, you know, from people who see what you do and can use it. And then you don't have to ask hundreds of people who can't use it, which is dreadfully inefficient. But, you know, I also, like, if I had tried to get some kind of, like, a proper salary position, I, you know, never, that was never on my horizon. So I just picked up work, you know, just word of mouth. But I never picked up anything like that word of mouth. But, you know, that could have been good, but I'm happy it turned out the way it did. You know, for all of the anxieties there are about freelancing and lack of health insurance and stuff like that, whenever I hear people who have a good paying salary position but are being driven nuts by it, you know, and it's great if you have one that you're not driven nuts by, but You know, I just think, oh boy, I don't have to worry about that. Or just the sort of weird irrational forces reigning and the weird sort of subjugations that can go on in whatever institutions or companies. But, you know, they're all different. It's so funny, just like all families are different, or all groups and all the group dynamics and all the weirdness. But luckily, I've gotten to just be, for the most part, a sole proprietor, and I get to just do my thing off in a corner. And I did okay by it.
Oh, well, we're almost out of time, but there was one thing I really wanted to hear about that I guess we just didn't get around to. How did you get into building your own instruments?
Well, I got interested in instrument building when I first got to New York. I played in a band with my friend Matt Verdery, and there was a guy named Paul Skelton, a bass player who was from Texas. We had a band called Triggerfish, and I was playing around with this zither that was a kind of a homemade instrument that was about 100 years old that I got at a junk store in Ripon, Wisconsin. So I remember it was all kind of peeled up, and I did some things to fix it up and put a contact mic on it. And so I was enjoying playing solo shows and singing with this zither, and putting it through a distortion pedal, putting it through a fuzz box, and getting a kind of gritty electric guitar sound out of the zither. But you know, it didn't have a magnetic pickup like an electric guitar. It had this contact microphone, and Paul worked in a electric guitar factory. He said, "You know, you should have a solid body electric zither." I said, "Yeah, sure." He said, "No, that would be easy to make. I'm going to start working on a prototype tomorrow. So, and I'm going to work with this guy who at first he's going to poo-poo the idea, then later he's going to look at me and say, you know, a better way to do that would be this." And so he was getting all excited about doing this. But then a bunch of people got fired from the factory, and he quit and moved back to Texas. But before he went, he gave me a whole box of pickups that couldn't be resold because they had to be taken out of something and were tainted in some way, but were perfectly fine. And so he was the one who put the bug in me to make a solid body electric zither, and I used the pickups that he gave me. And it was just out of the necessity of, you know, wanting to have an instrument that worked better in a live situation, and then I could change the string lengths and some of the tuning. And so then I got into just that you can specify the kind of instrument that you want for the kind of thing you want to do if it's something that isn't already made or easily obtained. It's kind of the only where left to go. And then you can make things happen that, you know, maybe might not happen on another instrument. This old zither that I already had, and the an old friend of mine, Tommy Jordan, who I met in college, who's a musician, he was a really good hammer dulcimer player, and he introduced me to the hammer dulcimer, which has these multiple courses of strings. So, like a piano, you'll have three or even four strings tuned to the same note. And so instead of just hitting one string with a hammer, you're hitting these four strings that are very close together, you know, almost making a kind of a band. And the sound of that is such a wonderful chorus. And also there's the multiple articulation of the strings. You hear the sort of like a little brr, this flaming crunch as you pluck the strings. And so I got really into that sound and the complexity of sounds that have several notes or several articulations, but it's in a single instrument, but it has this kind of choral and multiple effect. And so then I got to make the solid body electric zither and ended up being able to buy a Leslie cabinet from somebody and played the zither through the rotating speaker and through the, you know, the fuzz box. So that's what got me started on it. Yeah. I remember being very excited about buying a Hammond organ, a little spin at Hammond organ when I was a teenager. You know, the Hammond organ is the organ that you hear on jazz records or rock and roll records, or especially distorted organ, like, you know, you would hear in Deep Purple or the progressive rock bands, you know, or Emerson, Lake and Palmer, or Yes, or Genesis. You'd hear these Hammond organs and Leslie cabinets with the spinning speakers. Had the singular sound. So I remember buying, somebody had one of these organs in a barn or something. It was all full of sawdust and stuff. And I still have it. It's in my living room in Catskill. And it just has such a great sound, and it's such a funny beast of an instrument. Because it's this electromechanical thing. It has this motor in it and this axle, and it spins these wheels in front of the pickups, and it generates the sound in a mechanical way, but it's all electric. Yeah, those things were just built like tanks.
Thanks so much. It was really great.
Oh, sure.
I guess one thing I really wanted to do, at the very end, was listen to play a song.
Sure. I feel funny because I'm not really practiced, but we'll see how it goes.
Okay.